A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's heavy. He's describing something a lot of Israelis are feeling right now, that the fundamental contract between citizens and the government has broken. You're running to a shelter one day because Iran just launched a barrage at the country. 72 hours later, you're told the regime has been dealt a decisive blow, everything's fine. Then you read a UN intelligence assessment saying Iran's drone production is already back at 60% of pre-strike capacity. Which one is true? The answer, apparently, is both. And neither. He's asking what a real, cogent reform movement would look like, beyond just being against the current prime minister.
That cognitive whiplash isn't just uncomfortable, it's a symptom of something deeper. A contract has been broken. And I want to be precise about what that contract actually is, because it's not abstract. It's, I pay my arnona, I show up for milium, and in return you tell me the truth about existential threats and don't exempt other people's kids from service to keep your coalition alive. That's it. That's the deal.
Right now, none of those things are being delivered.
None of them. Let's ground this in the specific timeline, because the April attacks and their aftermath really did expose the gap between what the government claims and what citizens actually experience. April 12th, the Prime Minister says Iran's offensive capability has been destroyed. Those are the words. 1 week later, April 19th, the U Director of National Intelligence releases an assessment saying Iranian drone production is already at 60% of pre-strike capacity. These two statements cannot both be true. And nobody in the government has even attempted to reconcile them.
That's the mechanism, isn't it? The PM says X, the U says Y, and by the time anyone can verify, either claim the news cycle has already moved on. This isn't incompetence. It's a system designed to never be held accountable for any single statement.
The fog of war becomes a feature, not a bug. You release partial data, you let U intelligence contradict local claims, and you never, ever go back to reconcile the two. Citizens are left holding contradictory narratives with no way to determine which one reflects reality, and the government benefits from that confusion, because confused citizens can't pin accountability on anyone.
The Swiss cheese problem. Daniel used that phrase. Netanyahu's remarks are holier than a piece of Swiss cheese, and he's right. The gaps aren't just gaps, they're the point. Each hole creates space for citizens to fill with distrust, and distrust fragments people. It makes coordinated political response nearly impossible. Think about it practically. If you're trying to have a conversation with your neighbor about what the government should do differently, and you can't even agree on what the government actually did, that conversation is over before it starts.
And let me give you three specific statements from that April to May window that illustrate exactly this. Statement 1, April 12th, Iran's offensive capability has been destroyed. Statement 2, April 28th, the Prime Minister tells the Security Cabinet that Iran has been significantly degraded. Notice the downgrade in language, but still no numbers, no metrics. Statement 3, May 14th, the White House issues a readout saying Iran's missile production facilities are partially operational. That's a long way from destroyed, and none of these statements were ever walked back or clarified. They just sit there, contradictory, creating exactly the kind of information fog you're describing.
It's the informational equivalent of a shell game. And here's what makes it particularly galling in this moment. The home front actually performed. Citizens ran to shelters. Reserve duty numbers went through the roof. Civil society mobilized in ways that frankly stunned outside observers. I remember reading reports of people driving from Tel Aviv to the south to deliver supplies to families stuck in shelters, completely self-organized, no government coordination. And the response from the government was to treat those same citizens as if they don't exist, as if they're medieval subjects unworthy of coherent information.
Which brings us to the municipal tax paradox, because this is where the broken contract becomes measurable in shekels. Jerusalem's arnona rate in 2026 is 28.5 shekels per square meter for residential. 22.3. Jerusalem is paying the highest municipal taxes in the country. And what do residents get for that premium? Jerusalem ranks 14th out of 15 major cities in municipal service satisfaction, according to the Israel Democracy Institute's May 2026 survey.
14th out of 15. So you're paying top shekel for bottom-tier services. And let's put that in human terms for a moment. You live in Jerusalem. Your street has potholes that haven't been filled in 18 months. The public park near your apartment has broken equipment your kids can't use safely. You call the municipality about a sanitation issue and you're on hold for 45 minutes. Meanwhile, your cousin in Tel Aviv pays less and gets faster response times and better maintained public spaces. That's not just inefficiency. That's a structural failure of the basic promise that taxes buy services.
It gets worse. The May 2026 Jerusalem Municipality Budget Report shows that 22% of Arnona revenue goes to what are euphemistically called coalition-mandated pet projects. 22%. That's nearly a quarter of every shekel Jerusalem residents pay in municipal taxes, diverted to things that have nothing to do with fixing sidewalks or improving schools or maintaining public spaces.
The contract breaks down at the most basic level. You pay, you don't receive. You serve, others don't. You ask for information, you get contradictory statements and silence. At some point, the question stops being, why are people disillusioned? And starts being, why would anyone still trust this system at all?
That's where the tipping point argument comes in. Because I think Daniel's right, the anecdotal sense of disillusionment is backed by hard data now. The Israel Democracy Institute poll from May 2026 is striking. 73% of Israelis rate the government's performance during the Iran crisis as poor or very poor. 73%. But here's the number that should keep coalition strategists up at night. 58% of right-wing voters agree.
That's the misconception that needs to die immediately. The idea that this is a left-wing complaint, that the broken contract is just the usual suspects griping about the usual things. 58% of right-wing voters. This is cross-factional in a way that Israeli politics hasn't seen in decades. And I think that number actually understates the reality, because there's a social desirability bias at play. Some percentage of people who still identify as coalition supporters are going to be reluctant to tell a pollster they think the government failed, even if that's what they actually believe.
The real number might be higher. And then the Knesset drops the child care exemption bill on May 18th. This thing passes its preliminary reading, and it is a perfect microcosm of everything we're talking about. The bill exempts draft dodgers from child care expenses. The estimated cost is 340 million shekels annually. And in the exact same Knesset session, the Homefront Command's civil defense budget was cut by 180 million shekels.
Let that sit for a second. They cut civil defense funding, the thing that keeps people alive during rocket attacks, by 180 million shekels, while simultaneously passing a bill that gives 340 million shekels in childcare benefits to people who don't serve. The math isn't just bad, it's insulting. It's the kind of thing where you read the headline and you think it must be a parody account. But it's not. It's the actual Knesset.
It's a statement of priority so stark that no amount of spin can obscure it. Coalition survival over civil defense, keeping the government together over keeping citizens safe. And the mechanism here is important to understand. This isn't the government being incompetent at governing. This is the government being extremely competent at one specific thing, distributing resources to the constituencies that keep it in power while externalizing the cost to everyone else.
That's the part that creates the begrudgment Daniel mentioned. It's hard to pay taxes without feeling a sense of begrudgment. And begrudgment is actually the right word here. It's not anger, not yet. It's that slow, corrosive awareness that the system is extracting from you and giving nothing back. Your Arnona goes to pet projects. Your reserve duty buys you a government that exempts other people's kids. Your trust buys you contradictory statements that were never intended to be reconciled. It's like being in a relationship where you're doing all the emotional labor and the other person isn't even pretending to meet you halfway anymore.
Here's where it gets interesting. Because that disgust, that total, profound disillusionment, is creating something unexpected.
That's the pivot. Because Daniel's framing of this as an opportunity is exactly right. When 73% of citizens agree the system is failing, the Coalition for Reform is already built. It doesn't need to be created. It needs a positive agenda.
Let's talk about why the anti-Netanyahu movement failed, because understanding that failure is essential to building something that works. The movement was purely negative. It was focused entirely on removing one person from office. And negative coalitions have a structural problem. The only thing holding them together is opposition to a common enemy. The moment that enemy is gone, the coalition fragments. You saw this play out in real time. The movement could mobilize hundreds of thousands of people for protests, but it could never articulate what it was for, just what it was against.
It was the political equivalent of a demolition crew with no architectural plans, very good at tearing things down, no idea what to build in its place, and I think there's an uncomfortable question embedded in that failure. Was the movement actually trying to build something? Or was the protest itself the point? There's a certain kind of political activism where the catharsis of the demonstration becomes the product. You show up, you chant, you go home feeling like you did something. But you didn't actually change any structures.
That's a sharp critique, and I think it's accurate. The protest as emotional release rather than political mechanism. And Daniel's critique is correct. The movement was justly criticized for being thin on policy. But the question he's asking is the right one. What would a cogent change of government policy actually look like? Not who should lead, but what should they do?
That's the generational challenge. The architects of the state, Ben-Gurion, Herzl, they weren't just movement leaders, they were institution builders. Herzl didn't just write pamphlets. He built the Zionist Congress, a functioning parliamentary body, before the state even existed. Ben-Gurion didn't just give speeches, he built the apparatus of statehood, the IDF, the civil service, the legal framework. The current moment needs institution builders, not just protest organizers.
Let me offer three concrete policy pillars that could form the basis of a positive reform platform. These aren't imported from some foreign model. Each one is grounded in existing Israeli legal frameworks. Pillar 1. Mandatory transparency legislation. Currently, security cabinet minutes are classified for 30 years by default under Section 18 of the State Comptroller Law. That means by the time citizens can see what their leaders actually discussed during an existential crisis, those leaders are long out of office and the crisis is a historical footnote.
That's absurd on its face. My kids will be older than I am now before I can read what was decided during a crisis I lived through. How is that defensible?
It's not. And the proposal would be this. All security cabinet decisions must be declassified within 90 days unless a supermajority, say 2/3, votes to extend the classification. And that extension would have a hard limit of 1 year, renewable only once. The default becomes transparency. Secrecy becomes the exception that requires active justification, not the automatic reflex.
Which would instantly change the incentive structure. If you know your decisions will be public in 90 days, you govern differently. You can't just say Iran's capability is destroyed and hope nobody checks. You know they will check. And they'll be able to.
Pillar 2. Municipal tax reform. Tie 15% of Arnona revenue directly to measurable service delivery benchmarks. Satisfaction surveys, response times for municipal requests, infrastructure maintenance metrics. If services improve, revenue increases. If services decline, revenue drops. This was actually piloted in Tel Aviv in 2024, and it worked. They saw a 12% increase in citizen satisfaction after implementation.
It's not theoretical. There's proof of concept. And 12% is significant. That's not a marginal improvement.
It's proven. And it changes the relationship between municipality and resident from taxation without representation to something closer to a service contract. You pay, you get. If you don't get, you pay less. Pillar 3. A citizen's contract law. Any bill that creates an exemption from national service, military, civil, whatever form it takes, must simultaneously fund an equivalent alternative service program. You want to exempt a constituency from service. But you have to fund the alternative. No more passing child care exemptions for draft dodgers while cutting the Homefront Command budget in the same session.
That's elegant because it doesn't try to solve the draft exemption problem directly, which has been politically impossible for decades. It just changes the accounting. You can still do it, but it costs you something visible and immediate. And here's what I like about it. It doesn't require anyone to admit they were wrong. It doesn't require the Coalition to say we shouldn't have exempted these constituencies. It just says from now on, every exemption comes with a bill. That's politically sellable in a way that moral arguments about fairness aren't.
It makes the trade-off explicit. Every exemption has a price tag, and that price tag is an alternative service program that benefits the entire country. If the Coalition still wants to pass the exemption, they have to look voters in the eye and say, we chose this constituency's benefit over that national program. No more hiding the cost in obscure budget line items.
These three pillars together form something coherent. They're not just a grab bag of reforms. Transparency forces accountability. Municipal tax reform forces service delivery. The citizens' contract forces fairness. Each one addresses a specific break in the contract between citizen and state.
They're designed to be politically viable because they don't require constitutional revolution. Each one uses existing legal frameworks, the state comptroller law, municipal tax codes, the budget process. They're amendments, not overhauls. That matters for actually getting them passed.
Let's talk about the information asymmetry mechanism more directly, because it's the engine that makes all of this possible. How does the government actually maintain this fog?
There are three layers. Layer one is the contradictory statements we already discussed. The PM says one thing, you intelligence says another, and nobody reconciles them. Layer two is classification. Everything that might be embarrassing or contradictory gets stamped classified and buried for 30 years. Layer three is what I'd call narrative flooding. The government releases so many partial, incomplete, or misleading data points that citizens can't assemble a coherent picture. Each individual statement might be technically true in isolation, but together they create a picture that's fundamentally false.
The Swiss cheese, again. Each slice has holes. Stack enough slices together and you can't see through any of them, but you're still not getting solid information. It reminds me of those magic eye pictures from the 90s. You're supposed to unfocus your eyes and see the hidden image, except in this case, there is no hidden image. You're just staring at static that was designed to look like it might resolve into something meaningful.
That's a perfect analogy. And here's the thing about narrative flooding. It exploits a specific cognitive limitation. Humans are pattern-matching machines. We try to assemble coherent narratives from the information we have. When you're fed contradictory data points that can't be assembled into a coherent narrative, your pattern matching breaks. You default to distrust. But that distrust becomes generalized. It's not directed at specific policies or specific failures. It's just a fog of cynicism, and a cynical population is actually easier to govern than an angry one, because cynical people don't organize.
That's a chilling insight. The goal isn't to convince you things are going well. The goal is to convince you that nothing can be known, so there's no point in trying to hold anyone accountable. It's governance through epistemological exhaustion. You just wear people out until they stop asking questions.
That's why the transparency pillar is so important. It breaks the narrative flooding mechanism. If security cabinet decisions are public within 90 days, you can't flood the zone with contradictory statements because citizens can eventually check. The 90-day window gives the government operational security during an actual crisis, but it prevents the permanent fog.
Let me push on something. The child care exemption bill, 340 million shekels. The home front command cut, 180 million. These numbers are so stark that they almost seem designed to provoke. Is this just the coalition being so confident in its position that it doesn't care about optics, or is there something else going on?
I think it's more structural than that. Coalition politics in Israel's proportional representation system creates a specific dynamic. Small parties, and I mean parties with 4, 5, 6 seats, hold disproportionate power because they're the difference between a 61-seat coalition and a 59-seat one. The prime minister needs every single one of them. So each small party can extract concessions that are wildly out of proportion to their electoral mandate.
The tail wagging the dog, but the tail is holding a knife.
Demanding 340 million shekels in child care exemptions. The coalition isn't confident. It's captive. Every budget cycle becomes a hostage negotiation where the hostages are basic governance functions. Civil defense gets cut not because anyone thinks that's a good idea, but because the money had to come from somewhere, and civil defense doesn't have a dedicated party threatening to bring down the government. no one's coalition membership depends on well-maintained bomb shelters.
Which brings us back to the unity point. Because if 73% of Israelis are disgusted with this, across left and right, religious and secular, then the political math changes. A reform coalition doesn't need to convince everyone. It needs to convince enough people across enough factions that the current system is extracting from all of them. And the extraction is the key word. It's not that the government is failing to deliver services equally. It's that the government is actively taking from one group to give to another, and the taking is happening in ways that are deliberately obscured.
That's where the positive platform becomes essential. The anti-Netanyahu movement proved that disgust alone isn't enough to sustain political organization. Disgust is a great motivator for showing up to a protest. It's a terrible motivator for the grinding, boring work of policy development and institution building. People will march against something for months. They'll only build something for years if they believe in what they're building.
Let's talk about what building looks like. Daniel mentioned that the episodes about Ben-Gurion and Herzl were instructive, and he's right. Herzl wrote The Jewish State in 1896. That was a detailed policy blueprint. It covered everything from labor laws to flag design. He didn't just say, we need a Jewish state. He described how it would work. Where is the 2026 equivalent for Israeli governance reform?
That's the Herzl challenge, and it's a real one. The reason Herzl's blueprint worked, and I'm using worked loosely, obviously the actual state looked different from his vision, but the reason it was effective as a political document is that it made the abstract concrete. You could read it and imagine the thing. You could argue with specific proposals rather than vague aspirations. Someone could read his section on the 7-hour workday and say, I disagree, it should be 8, and now you're having a real policy debate instead of a values debate.
That's what the current reform impulse is missing. There's plenty of disgust. There's plenty of someone should do something. There's very little, here is the specific legislation. Here is the budget. Here is the implementation timeline. I can hand you a stack of op-eds about what's wrong with Israeli governance. I couldn't hand you a single document that lays out a comprehensive reform plan with legislative text attached.
I want to point to something that gives me hope, though. There's a program called the Neset for Tomorrow Fellowship, launched in 2025. It trains 30 young professionals annually in legislative drafting and policy analysis. Not in protest organizing, not in campaign messaging. In the actual mechanics of governance, how to write a bill, how to analyze a budget, how to structure a regulatory framework.
That's exactly the kind of thing that matters. Movements need lawyers and policy wonks, not just charismatic speakers. And 30 people a year isn't enough, but it's a start. Do we know anything about where these fellows end up? Are they actually getting placed in positions where they can use these skills?
A few have been hired by Knesset committees as legislative aides. Others have gone to policy research institutes. A couple have joined municipal government. It's not a pipeline yet, but it's the beginning of one. And 30 people a year isn't enough, obviously, but it's a proof of concept. It shows that there's demand for this kind of training, that there are young Israelis who want to be institution builders rather than just movement participants.
Let's get specific about what listeners can actually do. Because the audience for this show is informed and engaged, they're not looking for Write Your MK as actionable advice. What's the concrete path?
First, demand specific policy proposals from any reform candidate or movement. Not, I'm against the current government. Not, I'm for change. If someone says they want transparency, ask them what their declassification timeline is. If they say they want fair service, ask them how they'd reform Arnona. If they can't answer, they're not serious.
Treat every vague promise like a job interview answer that dodged the question. Tell me about your experience with municipal tax reform. I believe in fairness and accountability. And I'd add, do this publicly. Ask the question at a town hall. Post it in the comments of their social media. Make vagueness uncomfortable.
Second, track municipal budget allocations using the Open Budget Portal at opengovernment.org.il. That 22% figure I cited, that came from public budget data. Any citizen can find it. And once you find it, you can take it to your local council member and ask them to justify it, at a council meeting. That's not protest, that's accountability.
Accountability is uncomfortable in a way that protest isn't. 100,000 people in the street is a spectacle. One citizen at a council meeting with a specific budget line item and a specific question. That's a problem. That's the kind of thing that makes elected officials shift in their seats, because they can't dismiss you as part of a mob. You're a constituent with a receipt.
Third, support organizations that are building the institutional infrastructure for transparency. The Movement for Quality Government is the obvious one. They've been doing this work for decades. But there are newer groups, too. The Israel Democracy Institute produces the polling and policy analysis that makes arguments like this possible. These organizations need funding and attention. They're the institutional memory that a reform movement needs.
This is where the generational shift argument comes in. Daniel said a new generation must emerge. He's right. But that generation needs to be trained in governance, not just protest. You can't build institutions with slogans. You can't draft legislation with a chant. The skills are different. They're less glamorous. Nobody puts budget analysis on a protest sign. But budget analysis is what actually changes how money gets spent.
There's a line from Ben-Gurion that I keep coming back to. He said that the test of a leader is not what they do in a moment of crisis, but what they build that lasts beyond the crisis. The institutions he built, the IDF, the civil service, the legal system, those lasted 75 years. They're straining now, but they lasted. The question isn't whether Ben-Gurion and Herzl would be disappointed in the current state of the country. They probably would be. The question is whether we can build the next generation of institutions before the current ones collapse under the weight of broken trust.
That's the open question I want to leave listeners with. Can a movement built on disgust evolve into one built on a positive vision? Or will the coalition of the disillusioned fragment the moment the common enemy is gone? Because that's the pattern. That's what always happens. Disgust unites, victory divides. We've seen it play out in movements around the world. The Arab Spring, Occupy Wall Street. Massive energy, real grievances. And then the moment comes to actually govern, and the coalition shatters because nobody agreed on what came next.
The Herzl challenge is still sitting there. He wrote a detailed blueprint for a state that didn't exist yet. Where is the 2026 equivalent, a detailed blueprint for reforming the state that already exists, but has lost the trust of its citizens? Who's writing that document?
Not a manifesto, not a protest sign, with specific legislative text, something you could hand to a nascent legal advisor and say, draft this into a bill.
The architects of the state built institutions that lasted 75 years. The current moment is asking whether anyone is capable of building the next 75 years worth of institutions. And the clock is ticking.
That's the thing about broken contracts. They don't stay broken indefinitely. Either they get repaired, or the relationship ends. And in the relationship between citizens and their government, ending looks like something none of us want to see. It looks like brain drain. It looks like capital flight. It looks like the people who can leave, leaving, and the people who can't, checking out. That's not a theoretical scenario. We've seen versions of it in other countries. It starts slowly, and then it accelerates.
If you're listening to this and you're one of those 73%, and statistically, most of you are, the question isn't whether you're right to be disillusioned. The question is what you're going to do with that disillusionment. Is it going to curdle into cynicism, which is exactly what the current system wants? Or is it going to become the fuel for building something better?
Building requires a different skill set than protesting. It requires patience. It requires specificity. It requires being willing to spend Tuesday afternoon reading a municipal budget instead of just sharing an angry post. That's less satisfying in the moment, but it's the only thing that actually changes the contract. The contract doesn't get rewritten by the person with the loudest megaphone. It gets rewritten by the person who shows up with the amended legislative text and the coalition to pass it.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop.
You can find show notes and more at myweirdprompts.com/201. If you found this episode valuable, leave us a review wherever you listen. It genuinely helps other people find the show.
Until next time. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
During the Cold War, Soviet medium-wave radio transmitters intended for domestic propaganda were so powerful that residents of the Azores could pick them up on their household radiators. The metal pipes inadvertently functioned as antennas, and the signal was strong enough to be audible without any radio receiver at all, just the radiator itself humming in Russian.
Right.
Right.
That's one way to heat up the Cold War.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.